and welcome to Game Changers. So I'm super lucky. We are recording this in June, so we are in Pride Month. Might not be released in June, but we're in Pride Month. Why not? So welcome to Game Changers. I'm Sharon, I'm your host, and I'm talking with a fabulous person today who is going to start talking about kind of representation, but from their own unique point of view, which is something that this podcast is very much about. Jamie Nicholas, can I ask you to introduce yourself and explain why you are here?
Hello. Yes, I'm Jamie Nicholas. I am a associate lecturer at Staffordshire University. My specialism is in production and visual effects. However, my research specialization tends to be into the lovely world of queer subjects and queer things and queer things in gaming, because I myself am a queer person. And it's interesting to me.
It is anyway, because so something that essentially I want to talk about quite a lot on this, and you know why I kind of do stuff on this as well, is representation. Because female, therefore, get to do the representation thing. As you say, queer, therefore.
It's a wonderful caveat that we get dragged into our professional workplace all the time.
There you are, you.
You.
Thank you.
happens everywhere I go.
But I suppose in a slightly serious way, it's because you are open about talking about queerness within game and within media, and sometimes people don't identify as queer or identify in a certain way, but don't really want to kind of talk about it, and that's cool too.
I actually see it as a necessary part of my role in the current climate that we are in, both politically and within the games industry. I think that the things I talk about when it comes to queerness need to be talked about, and simply the act of doing it. It doesn't matter what I'm talking about. I could be talking about Drag Race. I could be talking about the social economics of working with games in areas where queerness is being suppressed by governments. As long as I'm doing it, there'll be a queer person who's listening. And yeah, there'll be a queer person who's looking at me and going, that is a queer person working in the games industry. That is something that I like to see, because I myself as a queer person would like to be there. Obviously, they're not going to use as many words, and it might be an entirely unconscious thing. But just by existing and being open about who I am, I believe, maybe in a sort of Don Quixote sort of way, that I am making a difference.
No, I genuinely do think everyone who is not the norm, in inverted commas, so not what you would go, what does someone look like if they work in the games industry and what do they represent? That's that.
Yeah.
Anyone who is not that, there's someone out there who goes, oh.
Yeah, oh, exactly.
There's me. And something I'm super interested in, and I really want to talk to you about this a little bit today, is sort of that idea of not just people working in the industry being queer or representing a group that isn't normally seen or represented, but also kind of how game has or has not, because this is kind of, I feel like I'm a mastermind, this is your specialist area, not mine, how the game industry has or has not represented queerness and has or has not made it visible and accessible.
So, I mean, it's difficult to talk about the games industry in terms of like their actual actions when it comes to queerness. There are some really good examples. So there's an example where developers, I think about 25 years ago, on Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, the original, snuck in under publishers' radar a queer character and a queer storyline. Her name was Jahani. She was a Jedi, and she was a romanceable character in the game. And that was a really cool act of, like, queer resistance on the part of the industry. However, those actions are kind of few and far between. They're not very documented. And as games became bigger, there was obviously a lot more oversight going on in them, so you get less of that kind of thing. But what you... and I did a research piece on this. I did a quick look over the last 20 years, because that's the period in which I grew up with games, over where and how queerness has got into games. And one of the amazing things about games is they're an interactive art form. And being an interactive art form, it means that people are allowed to play with them, interact with them, and put parts of themselves into them in the same way that they can take parts of the games out. It's referred to on like a player character level as bleed theory by Marcus Montola, which I work with quite a lot. So, for example, most of the representation you see in sort of the last 20 years, a good chunk of it, is players putting their own parts of queerness into games. One of the examples I used, and this is still my favourite example to bring up, is that there is an episode of Shadow of Israfel developed by the Yogscast, which was a web series based in Minecraft, where I don't know if this was a queer person who did this or if it was just a person, but in either way, queerness ended up in the game that they were playing. It ended up in Minecraft because one of the sets they built for this roleplay series they were doing was a pastel mansion owned and run by two sort of very effeminate queer men, which you kind of got from certain illusions that they'd put in. So the characters, they'd made the skins to look a little bit like Freddie Mercury. I have just done the voice like Simon Lane does in the series, if anyone's wondering why I've just sounded like that. They made the sort of tone of the voice of the characters because they would read out the voices in their own voices, but they sort in a sort of very camp way. There were like a few pride flags hidden in some of the artwork every now and then, and I can't do it justice without mentioning the fact that there was a sort of sex dungeon made inside of Minecraft, which, I mean, if anyone's taken a deep dive into queer culture lately, they'll know that kink and sex are big parts of queer culture, and them making their way into Minecraft was quite a pivotal thing, quite an interesting sort of thing to examine as a researcher and as someone who was young and growing up with it. So a lot of the representation you'll see, and it's not perfect representation, there's going to be flaws in there, but a lot of it will be people who are interacting with our interactive sort of framework we give them as developers in sort of sandbox environments and community environments, and creating queerness themselves and creating the things that they see that were lacking in the game space in the last sort of 20 odd years.
So just out of interest, because again, not where I am, so I'm asking you, that's why you're here. Looking at that idea of players sandboxing and communities building and kind of making the space that they want within the playable areas, if that makes sense. So they're making the queer spaces that they want to inhabit. They're making the queer characters that they want to be, if that's how they want to experience the space. Have you seen any of that come through into more mainstream game at all? Or is it still very much, you know, about modding and about kind of building your own space and building your own community? I'm just really interested because there's sort of a lot of talk about inclusivity. There's talk about visibility, and being seen in a AAA game is probably a really kind of like pivotal moment to say.
Yeah, I'm going to start on community and then I'll lead into AAA games.
Lovely.
So in terms of community, what you see is a sort of, so from early on, so when I was growing up, so when I was first got into video games about 2010, 2012, this is when I got into video games, and video games as a wider community. I got into it via YouTube, so watching people play video games on YouTube. That has evolved, so YouTube's not really the main platform for people to get involved in those kind of communities anymore. It's still a big community, but a lot of the conversations you'll hear now around gaming tend to be around streamers and sort of live service entertainers. And that's what I want to talk about when it comes to queerness, because now that we're like a bit further on in the modern queer story and queerness on the internet, you find that a lot of these online spaces with things let's say Minecraft streamers, for example, some of them have massive queer followings. And I mean, I haven't done like the deep research into it yet, but there's a lot of things that you can say about games and those communities working together to create those spaces. So for example, Rambu is the streamer I'm going to point out in question, because a few years back, about 3 years ago now, and this is before Rambu had come out as queer, they ran a poll on their stream where they asked, it wasn't the world's most scientific poll. I think it went something like LGBTQ+ yes? And 70% of their audience answered yes.
They're the best polls.
They're fantastic polls. Yeah. Yes or no. Yeah. And we don't especially need to know how those people identify. They're openly saying they identify as queer. Now, Rambo at the time, I believe, had an audience in five figures. So we're talking tens of thousands of people. I can't remember exactly how many people responded to this poll, but it was somewhere in the thousands, tens of thousands. And this was before that Rambo had come out. So there was no information that they were a queer streamer or anything like that. So there wasn't that ideation, like, we're going to gravitate towards a queer streamer. Obviously, they came out later. That could be circumstantial. I don't know. But one of the things that struck me was that Minecraft was the game being played. Now, when we talk about games and when we talk about Sandbox, and we always end up talking about things like roleplay and things like D&D, another area of games which has a massive queer following, one of the things that I've worked on as like a hypothesis, and I'm sure other researchers have looked at this, is that the creative elements of games often reflect back into their audience. So with queer people, you see a lot of people wanting to remake themselves because they're not the gender they identified with at birth, well, they were assigned at birth. Or with sexuality, there's not a lot of opportunities for people to go out and, well, there weren't, especially back in, you know, 10 years ago at least, for people to go and explore that kind of if I say ideation, then that's an old word.
You've already used it.
Have
once.
I?
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. I will keep on using ideation. Apparently, it's one of mine.
My God, you're like a crypt keeper.
I am the keeper of the gaze. The creativity in these games reflects back in the people who play them. And I think the people who play them are often like drawn to those kind of games because of the freedom that they allow. So Minecraft, essentially, you can be anyone in that space, right? And this is reflected in things like RPG games as well, because RPG games, this is where I'm pivoting to AAA for you.
Thank you.
RPG games is often a space where you get things like character creators, and you get things like voice line and voice options, essentially giving the player the best possible ability to inhabit a character that's not themselves. So you'll see a lot of LGBT communities popping up around these games. And you also see a lot of LGBT people working in these games. So, for example, one of my personal heroes is a games writer called David Gader. I studied him in college.
So long ago.
It's like 8 years now.
Oh my
But David Gader was one of the original writers on Dragon Age and the Dragon Age series, and he was the original writer of a lot of like very famous queer characters such as Dorian Purvis, who was one of the first characters who was pointed out and said, this is a good queer character in game, good queer man in games.
Right.
He is a queer person himself, and like a lot of that gets reflected in his writing, so that you see him in those spaces a lot. And then you see people like me who grow up and obviously growing up as a queer person is still difficult. It's still a difficult realm to grow up in, especially with like how politics is currently and how we're currently, for example, treating transgender people mm-hmm. in British media. It's still a difficult place to grow up in, and you'll often find that younger audiences and people who are queer will gravitate towards games like this because there is a sense of freedom. It's the same with, I did an interview with one of our lovely lecturers who's just left us in esports called Maddie. And in an interview with her, when I was talking about the fact that she was one of the first transgender esports lecturers ever, because esports was a course I believe we started here, one of the things she brought up was that online communities, so things like MMOs were a big thing for her figuring out her identity, or at least living as her identity, because games give us a sense of freedom to explore and be who we are in a non-permanent environment. So everything we do in games is in some way non-permanent. It happens in a controlled space. It happens in a game space. It's very rare for events inside of games to have any kind of real world effect. That does happen because we're insane as an industry, as in a sort of cool way, in the amazing reach and things that we do. But for the most part, things are self-contained. Which means I could go into a game, and if I wanted to, I could experiment, let's say in The Sims, by making myself as a female Sims character and see if that is something that resonates with me,
mm-hmm.
or see if I could try different clothes on, or see if I like a different hairstyle, or see if I can see myself doing different activities.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of freedom in the space.
So I'm just interested, because obviously people are within the space and they're creating the space for themselves, and they're don't like using the word experimenting, but they're perhaps living authentically within that space, or at least seeing how they feel within that space, within different representations of themselves.
Yeah.
Something that comes up for women in game and in online spaces is if it's known that they're a woman, they're open to let's call it bullying. It's not bullying as a sort of that schoolyard kind of concept. It's
borderline harassment.
It really is.
Well, it's just harassment, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. How is that in the queer space, or are these spaces a little bit more sort of community based and safer, or is that an experience that queer gamers also have? I'm just interested because it's sort of that idea of you raise your hand as not what someone expects and there's harassment, and I'm just interested. And you're not the spokesperson for all queer people. I know that, Jamie.
I'm not. I have a badge that says that somewhere, but I didn't wear it to this particular interview.
Shoot. No. I do know that. It's hard because you get put on the spot and you're like, so you speak for everybody.
I speak for the gays. I'm the Lorax for the gay people. With every community, there's problems. One of the ones I'm going to point out is mode. For example, in online spaces, we are always communicating with a level of anonymity, mm-hmm. And we're always speaking through a screen, mm-hmm. and not with our own personal verbal vernacular, mm-hmm. which means that the words we use are always going to be, you know, chopped and changed. Mm-hmm. The way we're interpreted is always going to change. So that's one problem. Mm. And then you've also got the problem that for a while, and in a lot of queer spaces, you encounter a lot of gatekeeping. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's been phrases thrown around like not being queer enough for certain spaces.
Okay.
Or
right.
It's rare. I will say I've only seen it once or twice in my 23 and a half years. Mm. But it's a thing. And there's also arguments around like queer people as a community. It's kind of an ironic thing to say because we don't all huddle together in like a car park somewhere and vote on, you know, like our policies. We're essentially a large group of people, like somewhere like an estimate between 1/6 or 1/10 of the population, mm-hmm. all kind of expected to have the same views, and we don't. Again, like that community is going to change from country to country. It's going to change from like space to space because everyone's going to have a different opinion. Echo chambers form in certain places as well. So it's very difficult to sort of come up with one concise, like, yes, the queer spaces are always going to be friendlier because it's full of queer people.
No.
Like every group and every subsect, there's going to be problems.
Of course.
So I think that's the most nuanced I can put it.
No, it wasn't a very fair question because we've chatted and you're sent into the space as the queer representative, and
yes.
I'll be sent into a space as woman.
Yes.
Oh, you know, there you go. There's some people from other spaces in
and there's people that me and you can't speak on the behalf of.
Absolutely.
Like,
and I
yeah.
wouldn't, and I you try very hard obviously not to, and that's why I wanted to kind of do that preamble of I know you're not the person who speaks for all queer people,
yeah.
LGBTQ plus people, like I know that, but it's just a really, because again you lump people together,
yeah.
because it's an easy way to approach a question or approach a concern or a concept, and it's a much more nuanced kind of sort of discussion than going, oh, it's brilliant being queer because it's dead safe in this community. It's not that at all.
But it is a problem we should point out as well.
Do
because
it.
There's been a lot of this where, right, there's been a lot of scaremongering around transgender people currently and the trans agenda and that kind of fear-mongering that's been put in place. And like, if looking back in 10, 20 years, we'll be looking at this with the same kind of approach that we looked at to do with like the queer panic during the 1980s.
Yeah.
It's the exact same thing. It's a conversation that's been kicked up to win an election, more or less. They're not going to win that election. I'm happy to say that on air. But
I can possibly say anything political. I
haven't said what party I'm referring to
true.
Infer. One of the issues you see during those conversations is a lot of the time they will not have that conversation with a queer person.
Mm.
Or they will find the need to invent a kind of balance around like two sides of a story. It's like this like notion in journalism that there's always two sides to a story.
Mm.
There's not always two sides to a story. Sometimes there's one side to a story, sometimes there's 10.
Mm.
And the fact is, like, a lot of the time, like, trans people aren't invited to the table to have that discussion. Their rights and their needs and their lives are being dictated by people who are not in the circle. And the same thing happens when we have this sort of tokenized representation model, because, like, I'll be called in to talk about... It's happened a lot when I was working for a union. I won't say which one.
No.
But a lot of the times, I would be called in to speak on behalf of communities who I'd had little or no interaction with. So, yeah. Like, queer people of colour, and queer people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a disability. I'm not neurotypical, mm-hmm. but at the same time, that doesn't include people who have physical disabilities.
Absolutely.
So I can't talk on their behalf.
To talk about that, does it?
Yeah, exactly. So we definitely need to... this isn't me having a go at you, Sharon.
No, I'm perfect,
I'm here to talk about queer stuff in games, which I can do. But it's an issue that I wanted to, like, put out there as a broader problem. Is like, if you're going to have a conversation, you need to invite all the people to the table.
Yeah. Something that it's a game, and I'm not going to remember the name of the game because I'm rubbish.
This would be like a mini game. You can describe the game to me.
I'm going to describe the game.
Wonderful.
To you, because talking of transgender, something that has kind of been really interesting to me in teaching narrative in game is that when we think of game, maybe a lot of people think of game, they think of the big games, they think of AAA games, they think of the ones that are in the news and causing a moral panic or like whatever it might be.
Oh,
or children are spending lots of money on it and, oh my God, the world's
original Mass
end.
Effect about 10 years
absolutely.
Ago.
So
absolutely.
So all of these things. but it's really interesting that a space where people can really genuinely experiment and kind of explore representation and kind of how they feel is the indie game industry is kind of self-made games or very small company games. And I sort of go, is it indie? Is it a person on their own making the game? Is it indie, you know? And there was again, I'm awful because I can't remember what the game, and maybe you know it, maybe it's one that's like well known enough that it sort of sparks
of
a memory. but this is an indie game, narrative based, very simple, not sort of, you know, you're not looking at AAA, but it's someone's journey through transferring gender, changing their gender, and the journey from self-realization, actually kind of how they experience that journey through to being in the waiting room waiting for their first consultation to actually start their, let's call it, surgical journey, if that makes sense, you know, to go on to that. And that idea of kind of these smaller spaces is a really interesting one, I think, where people can kind of offer these insights into an experience that maybe, you know, and obviously, so students were playing this in class. They were quite possibly not people who had thought about transgender, but they got something from it and they got a little tiny bit of insight into someone else's experience.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of idea of, because I think everyone aspires to big stuff, but there's these small spaces where you can kind of create.
This is a conversation that I love to have, because this brings us back to the idea of games as an art form, because games are a very big thing. Games are a very big media form, and it comes in all different shapes and sizes. I can't point to another media form that's got as much variation as games do. But yeah, we've mainly spoken about things that are like AAA.
Of course, because it's the
they're
go-to,
the big ones.
Isn't it?
They're, they're the big ones. So like Mass Effect, for example, had some of the first queer storylines in it. What you'll find with a lot of those storylines, this is changing recently, but you'll find that they're quite sanitized,
of course,
away from actual, like, so if you look at any kind of media from like 2000 onwards up until a point recently, I can't put a dot in it because media's flux, but a lot of like queer relationships were very sort of sanitized, or they're very one and done. Like the only thing you'd ever hear about a queer relationship is like, oh, these two characters are dating off screen.
Yes.
Or like something along the lines of like, you see them kiss once and then you never see them again.
Or also, I'll chip in with this one, because it's female characters as well have this thing, like the whole fridging thing, but that idea of those characters are there to help the cis person progress and understand themselves. So they're there as a side comment.
We're always a lovely example, aren't we, Shannon?
You always, always. But you know what I mean. You're there to propel the journey of whoever the main character is, and they are not a gay character. They are not a queer character. A lot of times, they're not a female character either. Yeah. You know, I just wanted to chip in with that as well because
it's the same thing, isn't it? But you find these very sort of cleaned stories where you don't get. A lot of, I'm going to call it the nitty-gritty of, like, queer relationships. Oh. You don't get a lot of things like sex scenes, for example. You don't get a lot of long-term romances. You don't get to see queer people in a romantic, like, long-lasting... Or it'll be the most sanitised, long-lasting, like, romantic relationship ever. Where it's the two queer men who are usually very outgoing. Yeah, you can tell that they've dialed it down because they're both wearing cardigans.
Oh, gosh, OK.
That's an example somewhere, but like that kind of stuff happened all the time. Okay. And you see a little bit of that in sort of queer characters in games. Mm. I can't really point to any like common ones because the sort of window for queer people to enter in into games, I believe, this is all from memory, came near the end of that kind of site, like queer people as background, non-impactful characters.
Yes.
Let's call them that. So you did sort of get this mix, but you also got this kind of sort of... You only really, in certain places, found queer characters fully as queer characters. Mm. So like Dragon Age, you got loads of it in that, but that had queer writers.
Yeah.
So
Therefore,
you get a more queer, authentic experience.
Yeah, the word authentic is the important one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because obviously everyone can attempt to...
It's not from
someone's experience, but then they don't have that knowledge and understanding of what that
is. And that happens a lot in AAA games.
Yeah.
It happens a lot in AAA games.
Yeah.
What changes when we jump back to indie is made by smaller companies or like single individuals is that you get that individual's like entire whatever they want to put into game goes into game.
Yeah.
That's how it works. And that's the beauty of indie. Is that you get like obviously despite all the issues with developing an indie game, like the lack of funds and how little support there is and publishing is so difficult, you still get the ability to put whatever you want into that. So for example, you get smaller indie games which will have more nuanced systems of things to do with gender and things to do with sexual identity and things to do with romance, because they have more time and a lot of the time more ability to input their personal experience.
Yeah.
So for example, there's a game called I Was a Teenage Exocolonist, which is a game by Sarah Northway, by Northway, I believe it's Northway Games or Northway Studios. Sorry, Sarah. The game itself is a story of you aging from age 10 up to age 17.
Right.
In space. In an alien colony where everyone's already a bit wacky and weird because they're in space.
Okay.
And it's the future. And there's this amazing system that's in there where I'm 90% sure you can do it at any point during the game. But I know at the start of the game, there's a gender slider.
Okay.
Between masculine and feminine.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of central space there where your character takes on a sort of... genderless, androgynous appearance.
Okay. So that's your central point, and then you can go either way.
And you can go either way from that, and it was wonderful.
Mm.
And it was just a very simple way of, like, obviously, human beings are very complicated creatures. Nobody really understands the how we were put together, or if we were put together. But what we can say is most of what's controlling us upstairs is a lot of magical goop. And I'm not a neuroscientist.
Go
ask Derek Shepherd. I'm sure he'll know. Get him back from the dead. Sorry, spoilers. but a lot of what's going up on upstairs, we don't really understand. Yeah. We're still researching it. But there's not really a sort of a one or zero system for things like gender or gender identity. For example, I could go and fetch Deej from the studio, David James, one of our lovely course directors, and sit him next to me, and you'll hear in our voices and from what we talk about that he's got a lot of he's a lot more masculine presenting than me. Okay. I'm still a masculine presenting person, but if we had to put it on a scale from 0 to 1, I'm at like 0.25 and he's at 0.55.
Okay.
So there's that difference there, and there's similarities across genders, and there's things that are entirely apart from gender that people will enjoy that aren't even associated with the gender.
Of course.
So it just doesn't. How we approximate that in games is going to be experimented with, and I think seeing that kind of experimentation in things like I Was a Teenager as a Colonist is awesome, because yes, we don't know, but here's a cool way of showing it off, and it's a bit more interesting than how we've been doing it otherwise.
Let's
play around with it.
And it's also interesting that you have the, maybe not in that game, but I don't know, because I haven't played the game, I've just heard about it today, but if we think about that slider.
Yeah,
and that slider is identifying our character in the way that we want to identify them. If we think about a game which maybe has a bit more kind of money behind it and facility to do it, then that starts to affect maybe how we can play the game, how the narrative evolves, what opportunities are offered to our character because we have that identification. I don't know if that was
also time and logistics.
Yeah.
Because some of these, so in for example, and this is talking to me about as a producer, a very practical sort of take on it. The slider in I Was a Teenager as a Colonist has when you slide it, the thing it does is it changes your character's appearance. It changes it between three different sprite sets.
Okay.
So you've got essentially three characters there that you can sort of slide between as you go.
Yeah.
That's great. That's fine. It also adjusts, I think you can also separately adjust things like pronouns. So you can go they, them, he, they, and you can manually do that kind of stuff. And you can do it where inside of like text boxes, your pronouns change based on who's what's going on and like how you're being addressed and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Logistically, on a bigger game, that would take a whole team quite some time to do.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when you get to bigger games, you get to things like character creation.
Of course.
And changing the character dynamically as the game goes along is doable.
Mm.
It just takes a little bit of time to implement it,
mm-hmm.
right? My argument as a very practical minded producer would be, if we can allow them to make their character at the start of the game and then every now and then give them something like a magic mirror where they can change their appearance, do we really need a slider?
Okay.
Right? It would be that kind of conversation, right? Because we're still, in terms of the game, we're still providing an ability for someone to go into the game and make themselves how they want to be. But it's not in such a artistic way as I Was a Teenage Sex with Columnist does. Because that slider is not just a user interface element. It is an expression. This is what people forget about games a lot, and it upsets me, is that games are an artistic expression. They are a media form. So whenever we make something in them, there are things that people can discern from that. And just by having that slider, you can say, you could just, 100 years from now, some poor English student's going to look back on this, or whatever we're calling it, and they're going to go, this slider represents Northway's view that gender works on a sort of spectrum.
Mm.
Right? And we know that from the slider.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that works.
Mm.
And there's things like, you could also construe that games give you, I'm not going to construe it now, actually, because that could have negative effects for hundreds of years. I'm kind of inflating my own ego here. It's like, in 100
hundreds
years,
of years,
some
time.
Poor students can be listening to this, and I'm going to be going, here's how you should write this in your upcoming essay that I assume you'll be writing with your mind.
In your PhD.
In your PhD. Go write your own. Games as an art form is something that we forget a lot, and everything we do inside of a game says something that we might not be understanding. A lot of the times with indie games, you get more of this understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times, game developers won't understand what they're putting in. And it requires a level of sort of an understanding of your own artistic expression to understand what you're creating.
Yeah. It works on every media. Just because you have the tools to make the thing doesn't necessarily mean you understand what you're actually delivering. Does it?
There's a lot of unconscious.
Kind of on board with me. Yeah, but it's all learned stuff, isn't it, as well? We learn what I'm from a film background, so let's go there just for a second.
Did an A-level in film, we're all good.
We're all good. Like, you'll understand fade out.
You.
A fade out to black.
Yeah.
Fade in from black. That has connotations. That has meanings.
Yeah.
But people go, well, that looks really cool. I'm going to put that all the way through this. No. No, 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 no,
no.
Because that has, I'm reading that in a very, very different way to sort of the like person who's just whacking those fades.
Somebody falling asleep.
Thank you.
It could be somebody waking up, somebody being knocked out. The speed at which you do it also discerns the connotations.
Absolutely. But so it's just, again, it's that artistic thing, and that's something that's kind of very dear to my heart. We've never spoken about this. Oh, my God, Jamie.
That's the next episode.
Oh, it is.
Understanding, like, actual, but, like, elements of your media becoming parts of the interpretation.
Yes, thank you. Oh, my gosh. Because it's this thing of just because you know how to do the thing does not mean that your message, let's go full kind of Marshall McLuhan, that your message is the one that you're giving.
Yes.
And if you don't understand that...
It's like how a font can change the meaning of a sentence.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Yeah.
And people don't get that. And I try to express this to every developer I work with as a lecturer, is everything you do will change something.
Yes.
It will change the feel of the game.
Yeah.
It will change maybe how the game is played.
Yeah.
It will change how the game is interpreted.
Mm.
And it will change something.
Yes.
And you don't have to fully understand every
nuance
because you're not going to.
No.
Right? We look back at Shakespeare and we read into stuff that he wrote that he'd probably turn around and go, what the heck are you on about?
Yeah, absolutely.
But there will be connotations that we throw in there that it's like could be massively misinterpreted in the future. We tend to forget that as game dev- I'm going to make a grand sweeping statement here. We tend to forget as game developers and game consumers that we are at the sort of birthplace or the start of a new media that's only existed for 70 odd years, and in a sort of actual like refined sense, like not even that, because
nowhere near that.
The changes we've made to it in the last 10 years change how games look from like the 10 years before that. We're already going through different renaissances essentially of gaming.
Yeah.
And this is the start of the art form. We determine the meaning and inflection that this art form is going to take on. Like this in 1,000 years, if we're still around, this is what's going to be looked back on as the start of interactive media. Not the start of games, because games stem back to rolling dice in you know,
Greek times and before.
Before that, Mesopotamia and all that, you know, that's the earliest one I can remember.
All that history.
I think Mesopotamia might be the first one. All that stuff led into digital. Right. And that combination is what we're looking at now. And it's the same as if like they discovered like new paint. Right, for games. But it's such a massive switch that it's going to be looked back on as this massive change in how we absorbed art, essentially, because that's what the thing is.
Yeah.
It's a new art form, and we at the forefront of it, or just at the coattails of it, are determining how it should be. And there's a lot of elements that are affecting this. There's obviously modern day capitalism is playing into that. Politics is playing into that, as well as things like identity and representation.
Yeah.
These are all modern concepts being put into a new art form for the first time. And it's a pivotal thing. It's not trivial, as some people may make it out. Like, as a lot of people who question, like, oh, really, do we need, like, female characters as protagonists?
Yep, go for that.
The answer is obviously yes. But they'll question it as, like, oh, is this something, like, we really need? And I'm like, yeah, obviously, because this art form is going to change the world. You can take, if I took a 3D print of a Minecraft creeper and I took it with me to any corner of the world, there'd be somewhere there who could point at it and tell me what it is. Because that's the reach that games have, right? Because we're in the digital age, and that is the ability that these games have, right? And that's like one of the big things I say about when we develop queer games and characters with queer characters in it, is we take these characters and we put them into games and we think, yeah, that's just in the game. But what we often forget is that those games will have a reach beyond our own little spheres of influence. They'll go out into the world and they'll go like across countries, they go across state lines, and they'll be played by anyone and anyone with the ability. And they'll be watched on YouTube and Twitch by anyone or anyone with the ability. So the things we put into them are important.
That idea of reach, and we're going to have to wrap up, I'm afraid. We've talked for quite a long time, actually.
Have we?
Yeah. Is really important. And I think I love that you brought it back round to that idea of, it, yes, it's a new art form, and but the stories that we tell now and who we represent and what we do with it. And something that was kind of missed out by that was just like how that's then going to be looked back on and reused and refigured and reconstituted and kind of how that's going to feed forward. These are all really kind of like, I want to talk to you again about it as an art form. You're coming back. But I'm going to say thank you so much for kind of exploring queerness in game and kind of, you know, being a person that someone can look to and go, that's me, or it could be me.
Oh
no, but it's really, it's super, no, it's super important. I genuinely feel it's super important. It's what, it's one of the things as a mere woman, but having female students come up and go, there's women people teaching game.
I had that little gasp of someone when I started talking about something to do with queerness
there
in games, and then made a reference to myself as like as a queer person. There was a little gasp in a corner, and I was like, I've done good this day.
I have done my mitzvah for this day. Your people are here. So on that note, thank you so much for coming in and doing this. I'm just really appreciative. I know it's you obviously can crack through a podcast with the best of them, so it's not a problem for you. Thanks so much, Jamie. This is the end of the episode. I'm very excited to hopefully get you back and we can talk again about stuff. Thanks, that's Games Changers. Bye.